Hey everybody, welcome back to the Motivational Intelligence Podcast, where we address a far-reaching problem in the modern world. Just because people know what to do doesn't mean they do it. It's our job on this podcast to kind of deconstruct success for you in a way that helps you understand, manage, and even change the motives that you have and that the people around you have, so you can be, do, and have more of the things that you want in life. Today we have Dave Naylor back in the house, EVP of Too Logical, and we're talking about failure. We cover a lot of ground in this perception of failure, how the media influences that perception, how we can fail better, and a major theme that comes about is us just taking the time to reflect. So enjoy this episode, grab yourself a cup of coffee, maybe grab yourself a glass of wine, and enjoy this conversation on failure with Dave Naylor.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is produced by the team at Too Logical. Too Logical is an international corporate training firm and the world's leading expert in motivational intelligence, which is the ability to understand, manage, and change the motives people have. Too Logical offers over 30 different keynotes, workshops, and full training courses to small, medium, and large Fortune 500 companies in 53 countries, a lot of which you're probably familiar with: Pfizer, Bank of America, GE, Constellation Brands, P&G, and more. All solutions are completely customized, and the feedback from these sessions will blow your mind. If you have any training or speaking needs or just want to say hey, head over to TooLogical.com.
All right, we are back. Dave, you're back in the house.
Back in the house indeed.
All right. How's the road?
Long.
It always seems to be.
I'm doing my level best to keep Marriott and Delta gainfully, all their employees gainfully employed.
Yeah, what are you, like triple, double medallion or something?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I got a few million miles on Delta now, and I think I'm about the highest level stayer at Marriott, so... But you know you travel a lot when you come into a hotel and they remember you from the last time you were there.
Oh, Mr. Naylor,
yeah,
you're back.
Yeah, I was traveling this week and the people at the valets at the hotel recognized me. The people at the front desk recognized me. So
yeah. Home away from home.
Indeed it is.
All right, well, I'm glad we were able to carve out some time today. Today, I wanted to take this opportunity to pick your brain, mostly selfishly, but a little bit on the behalf of our listeners, on the topic of failure.
Yes.
So I think failure is a misunderstood and misattributed element of a lot of different things, business and outside of business. And I think people misinterpret very often the role that it plays in what ultimately makes them successful.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of kick it off there. Why is failure important? Why is it an important part of succeeding in whether it's in business or in your relationships or whatever it is?
Hopefully you don't do it a lot in your relationships, yeah. But you know, that gets expensive pretty quick.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, if you think about it for a moment, rarely is the road to success smoothly paved. You know, there's always bumps in the road. There's always challenges and obstacles and those types of things. So I think you'd be hard pressed to find any success story of any magnitude that where everything went seamlessly, everything was perfect, there were no problems, there were no setbacks, and so I think it's important for everybody to really understand that in the process of succeeding, there's always going to be failures, if that's what you want to call them. You know, there's always going to be problems that get run into, but you know, the key is not to stop, you know, and that's what so many people do. They look at failure as being the, you know, a permanent roadblock from them being able to get what it is they want to get. And thus maybe they try a couple of times, and if they're not very quickly successful, they're not getting that instant gratification or instant positive feedback, they label something as a failure and they stop.
Yeah. when they, it seems like that label is, the difference is, you know, a label of permanence versus, you know, permanent versus temporary in terms of what that failure means.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I think intuitively, you know, people understand that. I think, you know, there's not a lot of people who are under the impression that the people that have ultimately been successful haven't had setbacks and haven't had failures. But if that's the case, and we intuitively understand it that way, why do so many people, you know, and I don't exclude myself from this, why do we look at failure as such a negative thing?
Well, I don't know if people necessarily intuitively know that. I mean, if you step back and think about it, if you absolutely knew for certain that whatever you wanted to achieve, you could accomplish, would you allow anything to stop you? You know, and, you know, so then we got to, you know, we have to step back and we ask ourselves, and I remember years ago, you know, a mentor of mine asked me a question. He said, you know, what is it that you want so badly in your life that you'd be willing to crawl over broken glass to get it? You know, and, you know, so I think that there's a couple issues, you know, the one of them is that, you know, I think a lot of people perhaps just simply don't believe that, you know, that the things that others accomplish and achieve in their lives that they can accomplish and achieve. So they don't give themselves permission to think big enough in that sense and to really believe in the, you know, in the beauty and the reality of those dreams. So I think that's part of the problem, you know, and I think another part of the problem is that, you know, so often I think the people they tie failure to their sense of self-worth, you know, so they if I tried something and it didn't work out, then I'm a failure. And that's really not the case. It's, you know, the reality is that the actions that, you know, that I took weren't right, but, you know, I can shift and change those actions. It doesn't mean that I'm a failure. It just means that, you know, that the actions I took didn't get me the outcome that I wanted. I think part of the other problem, though, too, is that I don't know that the media always does a wonderful job for people, you know, in this regard. You know, you look at the, you know, whether it's a, you know, the breakout singer in a given year, or the, you know, the breakout actress or actor in a given year, or that individual, you know, who started the, you know, the new tech company and those kinds of things, and those they get put on this incredible pedestal, and people, you know, they're doling out accolades to them, and we do a wonderful job of, you know, of making these people sound so incredible. But I don't think that the backstory is often particularly well told, you know. So the, you know, what were really the challenges and the hardships and the issues that this person went through, what were the setbacks that they had overcome, you know, what was the mindset that allowed them to overcome it where others gave up, you know, and so I think it convinces people to believe in that notion of overnight success, and overnight success is a myth.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with that wholeheartedly. I mean, most of when you get splashed on the cover of Forbes or Fortune, or, you know, pick the magazine or website, I think, you know, part of it is it feels like other people to an overnight success because they've never heard of this person, and all of a sudden they're on, right, you know, they're on the cover of Forbes. And then when you actually, and you know, we have short attention spans these days.
Yeah.
But even,
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Over here, Dan.
I'm sorry. I get distracted by this squirrel.
But I think even when you do dig into the story, it doesn't do a good job of diving into a lot of those details. It's, you know, it talks about how 2 months ago, all of a sudden they got all this traction, or they raised all this money, or they released this new single, and mm-hmm. then it just, everything blew up from there. And that kind of, they always seem to start the story at that inflection point yeah. that tipped them into, you know, fame and success. And it's easy to think that whatever that inflection point was the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
But the story most of the time started 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it's like, Anders Ericsson and his 10,000 hour rule, you
right.
know? And, you know, so the media does a good job of, you know, showing us the last 10 hours of the 10,000, you know?
Yeah.
And so they're not always, you know, showing us when Taylor Swift was 11 years old singing at a, you know, county fair or something like
right.
that. And, you know, and all of those types of things.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because that's not the glamorous part of success.
Yeah.
You know, and so if the media tells the whole story, what they're really doing is they're showing the hard work, they're showing the sweat, they're showing the effort, they're showing all of that. And, you know, and that doesn't sell as well,
yeah.
you know, as the concept of the, you know, the overnight success of somebody, you know. So it's kind of like, it's, you know, it's selling people the crack of success, you know,
yeah.
give them the quick hit, but
yeah.
don't give them the reality of what they really need, you know?
Yeah. It gives them the sense of like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, when they realize the whole story is they put 10,000 hours to being a master of it. Well, the fact that they became famous and successful isn't that amazing when you take that into consideration.
Exactly. Yeah. If you look at it in the whole, it's, you know, it begins to be a lot more believable, but then, you know, people, they discount those, you know, the, what happens in those 10,000 hours, they discount the challenges that person ran up against. They discount all of the people who said that, yeah, you're not going to be able to do it. Only other people can do it. They, you know, they discount all of the practice, all of the lessons that were learned, you know, all of those types of things. And, you know, for any of us, to really step back and ask ourselves, you know, so what is it in our lives that we've really given ourselves permission to practice for 10,000 hours?
Yeah, it's usually not one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, if the media is constantly painting it this way where, you know, from not only the hard work, but, you know, the setbacks and mm-hmm. those failures, they're not being painted in a, they're not really being painted at all.
Mm-hmm.
How does somebody who is now recognizing, okay, maybe I do need to get more comfortable with, you know, quote unquote failure and,
mm-hmm.
and looking at failure more as a short-term temporary thing and using that win or learn mindset.
Yeah.
How does somebody get more comfortable with the idea of failing?
I think that, and you said it a moment ago, and you know, it really is shifting one's perspective, you know. So it's letting go of that, you know, that belief that success should be easy, it should be comfortable, it should be fast, and you know, and you know, so just letting go of those myths or those false perceptions, I think, is a huge part of it. You know, so whether it's taking the time to, you know, to read about the backstories of, you know, of those individuals who really accomplish anything of magnitude. So just to remind yourselves of what the reality is, I think that's a huge part of it. I remember taking ski lessons as a kid and my ski instructor, he said, he goes, if you're never falling down, he goes, you're not trying hard enough, you know, and I think that's true of anything in life, you know, if everything is coming easy to us and we're not struggling at all and, you know, and we're in that comfort zone and, you know, then, you know, we're really not trying hard enough. And odds are what we most want in life isn't going to come to us because it just doesn't work that way. Falling down is a temporary setback when you're skiing, provided you don't break your leg or something like that.
Still temporary.
Just a little less temporary, I suppose. You're right. But it's more about standing up is really the key. I think that's the biggest part is it's recognizing that it's a temporary setback.
Yeah. And kind of developing, it's almost a habit that you need to develop, right? Mm-hmm. Of when you fall down, it's less important that somebody doesn't fall down and more important that they develop the habit of getting
standing back up. Exactly. The resilience that comes with that. And that's, one of the most common kind of characteristics you'll find in people that are highly successful is, that ability to exhibit that resilience, to be mentally tough, to not give up when the whole world is rallying around and saying, you can't do that. And I remember, when I was in grad school, I had I had two people in my life that were fairly close friends of mine, and it was funny. I remember one of them in particular, somebody I went to grad school with, spent a lot of time with, a very good friend of mine. And we got out of grad school and I went into business. I started my own business. He went to work for a corporation. And we would get together once or twice a week, just go out for dinner, drink, something like that. And it was funny. One night I was coming home after, we've been out for dinner and It was really weird. I had a great day, and things were going well in the new business and stuff. And so I went into dinner feeling very kind of charged, feeling good and empowered. And I came out and I'm driving home and I was feeling depressed, and I'm like, why the hell am I feeling depressed right now? So I just kind of filed it away and then the next week, we had gotten together again and again, I was coming home feeling depressed, I'm like, what the hell's going on? And so the next time we got together, I paid more attention to, kind of to the dialogue, what we were talking about, those types of things. And I noticed something that my friend did, it's like, every time I talked about, some forward-looking thing or something I was working on or something I was excited about, my friend kind of tempered it or, played a little bit of the devil's advocate or, took a little more restricted perspective, Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, I was trying to climb up a ladder and he was grabbing on my pant leg and kind of, yeah. And... and I remember driving home that night and going, I don't know if this is really healthy for me. And so next week rolled around and, he reached out, hey, let's grab some dinner, and I was like, I just can't this week, and I just kind of gave myself some space in that regard. And, and it was funny. It was, I just noticed how much better I felt, how much more positive I felt, and then, it went to the point where there were, years had gone by, and it was funny because, it was probably about 4 years ago. He actually reached out to me through LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen him in 20 odd years. Right. And probably more than that. And we got together for lunch, and our career paths, it was funny. He was still working for the same organization. I'd risen up a little bit in the organization, but not too much. And my life had taken an entirely different career path. So we were in very, very different places in our lives, in so many regards. And I'm sitting there thinking, here are two individuals who are literally in the exact same place when we were in our early 20s. And, you know, here we are now, and I won't use my age, and we're in very, very different places. And I wondered how much of it had to do with, you know, with just our own perspectives on the world. And I think, yeah. I think for a lot of people, the our perspectives can be heavily influenced by those around us, and not necessarily only always in positive ways. So sometimes, I think if you're really driven to be successful, you have to protect your dreams from those people who, you know, who for whatever reason don't believe as much as you do.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, there's the saying that you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with.
Yep.
I think there's truth to that. Why do you think people do that? Because I think a lot of times, you know, like, especially if people, I think that's a tough thing for people to deal with, mm-hmm. is especially, you know, people that they're friends with,
yeah.
that they care about, and, you know, to, I think a lot of people have similar experiences, mm-hmm. where you come away with that and you're like, wow, yeah. why am I feeling,
yeah.
you know, depressed coming away from this conversation? And, you know, once you put the dots together, mm-hmm. you know, they're not a bad person. They're yeah. not trying yeah. to do this.
Yeah.
So why do they do it?
I think that I agree with you. You know, I think I've met tens of thousands of people, you know, in life, and for the most part, you know, very few people are really malicious or have ill intent. You know, and.
Yeah.
They're, you know, people just aren't that evil, you know, and, you know, although, you know, you watch the news at night and you'd be inclined to think they are,
yeah.
but, you know, for the most yeah, part, exactly. you know, you travel around the world and people are people, you know?
Yeah.
We've got a gentleman in here in the organization, and he's fond of saying, you know, as he travels around, he goes, you know, people are people. He goes, I said, the same hopes and dreams, the same fears and doubts, no matter where you go in the world, you
yeah.
know? And I believe it to be largely true. You know, we know, you know, research teaches us that, you know, it's our thoughts and beliefs really regulate the way we interpret the world, the way we, you know, and the way we interpret the world or the way we perceive things, it, you know, ultimately dictates the, you know, the actions that we take, how we respond to different influences and things in life. And so I think that I don't think that people have malicious intent, but, you know, they see the world through a more limited perspective as it relates to themselves. And because of that, they can't help but see it through that same lens for everybody else.
Sure.
So I think that's part of it. I think there's also perhaps a part of human nature that... I think it can sort of attack at a person's esteem if somebody around them succeeds to a great extent and they're not succeeding, you know, so there's a desire, if you will, to keep parity in that average.
Because it makes them feel uncomfortable.
Exactly. Like, you know, why was Jerry able to do it and I'm not, type of thing, you know? So, and again, I honestly don't think that's a conscious thing that people do, but I mean, look at how we do it in the media. We love building people up, but we love tearing them down just as much.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it takes a very aware and mindful individual to sincerely want the very best for another individual and to be really happy for it when they get it and not feel any twinge of envy or jealousy or, you know, any of those kind of limiting emotions that, you know, that bounce around in people's heads.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, so much of it, I mean, so much of what we do on a daily basis is subconscious. It's not something we're making active,
mm-hmm.
you know, decisions about. It's just kind of a reaction
yep.
to what's going on around us.
Yeah. And our own, you know, and the, you know, the own, our own kind of mental compass, you know, mm-hmm. the, you know, our perspective or the viewpoint from which we perceive everything, you know, it's interesting. I've been reading a lot, recently about the reticular activating system, you know, and how it, it, you know, how it filters the way that we literally interpret everything that comes through our senses, and it filters it very much based upon those belief sets that we've established, whether the belief sets are optimally established or less than optimally established.
Yeah, and it's that kind of filter that those interpretations flow through,
mm-hmm.
and kind of like a prism, it'll either go straight through or it'll distort it.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's a part in particular that I think is really, really important, because I think it's the people that you surround yourself with are so important,
mm-hmm.
In just in terms of your own state of mind,
yeah.
and your own ability to succeed. Just like, you know, if you had allowed that person to get you depressed once a week,
mm-hmm.
your business would not have been as successful as it was.
Exactly. Well, you know, and it's in the, you know, but do you think most people ever really step back and truly think about that? Am I surrounding myself with people I want to be like, or am I surrounding myself with people I don't want to be like?
Yeah. And I think most people never step back and actually look at that.
Yeah.
And, maybe partially because they haven't thought to, and partially because they don't really understand how important that is or the effect that it's actually having on their life.
Yeah. You know, if I'm surrounding myself with a bunch of losers, I may feel like, isn't this wonderful to be the most successful? You know, I'm the tallest midget, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, but by the same token, you know, I may also have to accept the reality that I'm just a loser in disguise,
Right, so. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think the stepping back and looking at it is a huge part. And then also just having, you know, I think it's once you make that conscious decision, like that, I don't want to surround myself with these people. And when you've identified specific people, yeah. like this person's just dragging
yeah.
me, man.
Yeah.
That's a courageous decision to have to make, especially if they've been in your life. It's hard.
Oh yeah. But you know, again, you have to put a value on your dreams,
yeah.
you know, and what is, you know, we're each given some number of years on the planet, you know, and we really don't know what that number is going to be. And what is it that we want to make with that time, you know, and what if you truly could shape your life however you wanted to shape it? You know, what if you really could, you know, will something into your reality? You know, if success wasn't something that was just born to some and not to others, something that you read about in a magazine, but that you were really able to paint your life the way you wanted to paint it. And, you know, and if that in fact was the case, why would you ever allow anybody else to make your life anything but that?
Is there such a thing as absolute failure?
I think so. I mean, I think there's the, you know, the only way that I think there, that something is an absolute failure is if we stop trying, you know, and or we do something and we hit one of those roadblocks and we just, you know, we don't learn from it. So we never make any adjustment. You know, we keep repeating the same cycle, so to speak. You know, I think it was Einstein who said that, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting to get a different result. So I think the absolute failures in life are the people who don't try, the people who quit trying, and the people who do something and they don't learn from it and thus they just keep repeating the same mistakes. Those are pretty much absolute failures.
Yeah, those are really the only ways that you're not going to eventually get there.
Right, because you either you know, you either stop or you start, or you just keep repeating a disruptive, you know, pattern.
Right. Which is even that in and of itself is, it's hard when you're not, when you're doing the same thing over and over again and you're getting the same lousy result.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably going to eventually just give up.
Yeah, probably, you know. Or just, you know, move to a place of hopelessness and,
right.
You know, and, you know, oh, this is, you know, I'd be willing to bet there's, you know, there's decidedly people on the planet who, you know, they have just gotten to that point where, you know, this is my life, this is what it is. And they have lost that hope. You know, I've met people, fortunately not a lot of them, but, you know, I have met people who, when you sit with them, there's just no spark left in their eyes, you know, yeah. And they've just reached that point where, you know, they're in that hopeless state where they just don't, you know, they've fundamentally accepted the fact that this is what my life is and it'll never be better than that. And that's, you know, it's one of the saddest things to see in somebody. The saddest thing to see in somebody is when you see that in a child. But certainly seeing it in an adult isn't a whole lot better.
Yeah. Not fun. I think, you know, one thing I've been thinking about reflecting on recently, and I think is relevant here, is there's so much around the fear of failure. You know, I've just been thinking about, and I think maybe a first part of this is giving yourself permission to make mistakes,
mm-hmm.
As long as you learn from them.
Yeah, and that's you know, we talked about that before. It's you know, that's so much of the key is, you know, is that getting rid of that fear of making a mistake or that fear of failing. And I mean, I know we talked about that in our conversation around fear. But I think you're absolutely right, because as you know, you either attach an emotion to it or you put a label on it in a way that, you know, it's such a negative thing that it's to be avoided at all costs.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just for me, I know that's been a helpful question to ask myself, is if I feel that's an issue in a certain area of life, just saying, am I giving myself permission to make mistakes here?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times the answer is no.
Yeah.
So assuming we get beyond that, how do we fail better? If we're going to fail, how do we do it in the best way possible?
We are going to fail. I mean, that is the simple reality is that in, you know, in life and whatever we're going to pursue, we don't have perfect information. We don't, you know, circumstances aren't always perfect. And, you know, so recognizing that there is a certain inevitability to failure in that sense, because we're not blessed with, you know, perfect circumstances. So given that, you know, I think there's definitely some things that we can do to help us do it more gracefully or help us do it more constructively, if you will. You know, I think there's really four things as I'm thinking about it that seem to make the biggest difference. You know, the first I think is what you said. It's to, you know, give ourselves permission to fail more or fail more frequently in whatever it is that we're doing. You know, I think that's important. You know, I think that we have to fail faster. I think that when we fail, we've got to do it we got to fail forward instead of failing backwards, so to speak, you know, and I think last but not least, and we sort of touched on this before, we've got to leverage our failures, but then we got to let go of our failures. And you know, if you step back and you think about it, I think those are probably the four things that perhaps people struggle the most with regard to failure.
Yeah. Can you dive a little deeper on those?
Okay. I think it was Thomas Watson, who was the founder of IBM, who he was once asked what was the key to success, you know, and his response was something to the effect of, you know, double your rate of failure, you know. And so I think inherent in his response is that, you know, it's, if you're failing at something, it means you're testing a lot of things. And, you know, the more you test, the more feedback that you generate, the quicker you're able to adjust and adapt. Even if you do something and you do it wrong, at least when you step back, you've gained some kind of insight or some kind of wisdom that allows you to approach it the next time, from a more positive stance. And so I think that had a lot to do with this quote, is that, you know, the quicker you can go through the cycle, the quicker you can make those adjustments and the quicker you dial in that combination. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, the big thing in terms of the frequency is speed. You know, the speed at which you can go through it, the better you're going to be. And I think that ties into that second one too, which is, you know, about failing faster. You know, it's, it's one of the topics actually that's come up in a lot of the training meetings and the groups, the work that we've done with groups and things lately, is we've been talking a lot about creating high feedback environments. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at, you know, you look at a professional sports team, not only do they spend a lot of time out on the court or out on the field or in actual practice, but they also study those game films, they break things down, the reason they do that is for trying to create that high feedback environment, so that we understand that, you know, feedback is the fuel of the subconscious mind. It's what happens in the 10,000 hours of deliberate practice that, you know, Erickson talked about, is that people take in a lot of feedback, so they develop a high level plan. I think that, you know, certainly in life, and this, if anything, it's gotten greater. The pace of our lives has gotten greater. The flow of information has gotten greater. The distractions have gotten greater. So our time is more pulled and tugged in multiple different directions. And so often people complain about, you know, lack of balance and all of those kinds of things. And I think one of the negative outcomes of all of that is that people just simply aren't as reflective as they need to be.
You know? Yeah, they're so bombarded with things that they don't have, let me take a breath. And,
yeah. Yeah.
Think about what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this morning I was, you know, I'm standing in a Starbucks to get a cup of coffee, you know, and a group of us, standing there at the end of the counter, and you know, I just kind of looked around, and you know, everybody's got their phone, and they're, yeah, you know, they're going through their emails, and instinctively I reached for mine, right, and I realized I'd left it in the car, and I went through this moment of crisis, like, oh my god, what am I going to do with myself now, you know? And you know, and so because of that, there's always something that's pulling and tugging on us.
Yeah, I try to I've made like a conscious effort to do that, because it totally is the default now. Oh. Where you're waiting for something, you're waiting for a table, mm-hmm, at a restaurant, or you're waiting for a friend to meet you at a bar or something.
Yep.
Everybody's just sitting there on their phones.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a weird feeling when you don't do that, or when you're either you forget your phone in the car, or you're consciously choosing, all right, no, I'm not gonna pull out my phone. Like, I'm gonna sit here like a human being, and you know, take in my surroundings and maybe talk to somebody.
Or maybe take a moment and actually think about something,
what's going on. Yeah, exactly.
I gotta be spoon fed with information.
Exactly, and it's such this foreign feeling. It takes like some getting used to.
You know, and so, you know, now you project that onto our conversation here, and you know, we just don't allow ourselves, we don't give ourselves permission, or we don't put enough mental weight on the value of reflection. You know, that just taking that time to, to really look and say, okay, now what's working and what's not working, and where can I make an adjustment, and those kinds of things. And I think that's where people get into those patterns that we talked about before, where they get into that cycle of, I just keep doing the same thing over and over, even though it's not getting me where I really want to go, you know? So to fail faster, I think we have to be reflective enough to catch ourselves when things aren't going the right way. But if we're buried in something else or distracted by other things, I don't know that we catch ourselves.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's kind of a counterintuitive idea in terms of, you know, when you would think fail faster, you would think just more activity,
right?
You know, just keep going, keep moving, keep moving faster. And the reality is, if you do that, you're going to just keep doing the same stuff over and over again without actually taking a beat to say, okay, did this work?
Right.
What did I learn from this? What should I adjust?
Yep.
And without that breath, you're not failing faster. You're just
failing. Exactly. Yeah. So I totally agree, Sean. You know, and so I think that plays a big role. What was the next one we talked about?
Forward. Failing forward, failing in a progressive manner.
You know, it was, you know, I remember, I think it was Thomas Edison. I had a, Michelle and I, my wife and I, we years back, we took a trip down to, southern Florida, Naples and stuff. And, we found out that Thomas Edison's winter home and laboratory was down there. So, you know, one afternoon we decided to take a little road trip up to Fort Myers and visit it. And it was pretty fascinating, I have to say. I mean, I learned a ton about Edison in that. I mean, I had no idea he was the sheer magnitude of things that man invented was sort of awe-inspiring, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's obviously most famous for the light bulb, but I mean, there's so many things this guy invented in such a wide range of different areas.
Yeah, wasn't like concrete one of them or something?
Yeah, the toaster. I mean, you know, I mean, just crazy, the curling iron, you know, I mean, just crazy stuff that, you know, the guy invented.
Yeah.
And, you know, but of course the light bulb was the most famous. So as we're going through the laboratory was off to the side of the house, and there's all these shelves with light bulbs on them and stuff. And we go in the back side of the house, they have like this, you know, kind of a museum set up with, you know, telling a story and showing different inventions. And there was these little glass cases that had thousands of light bulbs in them, right? You know, different shapes and sizes and colors and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So there was a lady who was taking us through, and I asked her, I said, well, what's the deal with all these light bulbs? I said, did Edison like invent it and then decide become so fascinated he just kept making more of them, you know?
Yeah.
And it was interesting. She said, no, she goes, those are all, you know, she goes, those are all the experiments that he went through that didn't work. So I was like, well, you know, how many of them are there, you know? And she goes, we never counted the actual number of light bulbs. But she said, you know, Edison actually documented more than 10,000 experiments that he had gone through in the process of making electric light work. And so I was kind of blown away that somebody would have that kind of fortitude that they would, you know, keep trying different things over such an extended
period. I mean, think about the amount of time that one of those experiments would take.
Right. You know, and he's so, you know, he's got, you know, people traveling around the world, you know, gathering different elements and things that, you know, to he could, I mean, so it was a mass effort. It wasn't even just him. It was, you know, it was hundreds of people. And so it was one of those stories that I was really kind of drawn to. So when we got back home, I was doing a little research on Edison and the light bulb and all that kind of stuff. And I came across it. It was a kind of a funny quote. I guess at one point in time, a newspaper, reporter asked him, you know, Mr. Edison, you know, you've tried all of these, 10,000 times to figure out electric light. Why haven't you just come to the conclusion that electric light isn't possible and that this is just one of those failed ideas that, you know, this isn't going to work. And Edison looked at the guy and his response was something to the effect of, I haven't failed once in the process of inventing electric light. He said, I just figured out 10,000 ways it doesn't work. and I think you look at that and you kind of get a glimpse into the mindset of the guy.
Right.
You know, and
how he was looking at quote unquote failure.
Exactly. You know, and so it wasn't a failure because, you know, he learned something from it.
That element didn't work or
this. Yeah, so there's something that I learned here that I'm gonna put towards the next time I go at it, you know? And so I was in, I think it was a week or two ago. I was working with one of our large financial services clients, and, you know, so we had a group of, of their leaders together, and we were talking about the, you know, that win or learn mentality that, you know, that highly successful people or highly successful teams, you know, kind of weave into their culture where, you know, it's, you know, either I achieve what I want or I'm going to learn something that'll help me to achieve what I want tomorrow, you know? And it was really interesting because there's a lady in the group and, you know, as we're talking about that, you could see this light bulb, you know, kind of come on in her mind. And she, you know, she kind of looks at the group and she goes, that philosophy is so, it's so simple yet so profound. And she said, why don't we teach that to people? You know, she said, why, you know, she said, we've got this kind of win, lose, succeed, fail, you know, perspective that we teach people. She said, why don't we teach them the win or learn philosophy?
Often do you get that question.
Yeah. And that I think is that key to really failing forward is it's, you know, it's that win or learn. It's the, you know, it's, I haven't failed once. I just learned things that aren't going to work. Yeah. And so, you know, each one of those, you know, each one of those times that the combination doesn't open the lock, you know, you learn one more thing that's more likely to make it open next time. So that's failing forward.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think I feel like you get that question all the time is how come we don't teach this?
Yeah. It's probably one of the most common themes that we'll hear, particularly from parents in groups why isn't the things that we're talking about, why isn't this taught in schools, you know, or candidly, why isn't it even taught to parents, you know? So often there's a conditioning process that people go through, that puts more limitations on them than not, you know, and then they come out into the, you know, into the business world where we'll see them. And ultimately as business leaders, we have to try to figure out how do we take those limitations off those people so that we can take the limitations off our businesses.
Yeah.
You know, so we end up as business leaders, we end up dealing with the shortcomings of what was done in, you know, in each stage of this individual's development up till they get to us.
Yeah. Yeah. How about the last one? We kind of spoke about it in in relation to giving ourselves permission to fail, but and maybe part of that is letting go of it, of that failure quickly.
Yeah. I think that a lot of times people, they're relatively quick to let go of their successes, mm-hmm. but they tend to beat themselves with their failures for a long, long time, it's why do they, they do that? I think failure's tied to their sense of self-worth and so if they don't really believe in themselves, it just kind of further reinforces that, that lack of belief. I think it was Richard Branson who made the comment that in something to the effect of, in order to grow, you must let go, mm-hmm. To the point we talked about before, it's important to learn from those failures and take from them what you will. But I think it's also important to, let go of it and say, okay, that one didn't work, so I'm on to the next thing. Instead of carrying around that full executive set of emotional Samsonite of all of the things that we've screwed up in our lives, because we're going to screw up a lot of things in our lives. Yeah. So there's no shortage of things to beat ourselves up with, but carrying around all of that emotional baggage just ultimately drags you down. So if you can, if you can get to a point where you can, you let go of those shortcomings, take what you can from them, but then move forward, I think ultimately you're much happier. Yeah. And also much stronger in terms of the next time you come back at something.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. I think what I might recommend, and I think what I probably would agree with this, is after, maybe after people listen to this episode, grab yourself a glass of wine and take some time to reflect.
I'm never a guy to say no to
exactly,
that.
Exactly, that's what I figured. Yeah. Maybe you got any good wine recommendations?
We actually have a client who is in the wine business. They'd be rather happy if we mentioned Robert Mondavi or Franciscan uh-huh. or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Not to put any plugs in, but
right. Exactly. All right. Well, Dave, I think that about wraps it for today. Everybody, thanks for listening. You got anything any closing thoughts or anything you want to add before we wrap up here?
I think the biggest thing, and we touched on it, a few times in the course of our conversation, Sean, is that we have a lot more power to paint our lives the way we want to paint them than oftentimes we give ourselves credit for. And I think that it is, if we just give ourselves permission to take those shackles off, we give ourselves permission to kind of listen to that inner child that each of us has with that kind of sense of wonder and that sense of belief and hope and dreams, that ultimately we're much happier in our lives and much more successful. So it's shedding those things that ultimately hold us back and thinking more about what it is that we want in our life and less about what it is we don't want.
Great things to reflect on over a glass of Robert Mondavi.
Indeed.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Everybody else, we'll be back soon. Hey guys, one more thing before you take off. This is Motivational Intelligence Insider. It's just a very short, exclusive email every Monday that comes from Dave, John, and the guests on this show. This is the only place they share their very, very best stuff, and it's delivered right to your inbox every single Monday. This could include exclusive tips for upping your game, articles they're reading, videos they're watching, stories from the road, and on and on. It's the best way to kick off your week, and this content is comes directly from Dave, John, and the guests, and is only available to subscribers of Motivational Intelligence Insider. So if you want these guys and gals to email you their best stuff, go to 2logical.com/insider. That's the number 2logical.com/insider, and drop in your email. And if you do, I hope you enjoy.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is produced by the team at 2logical. 2logical is an international corporate training firm and the world's leading expert in motivational intelligence, which is the ability to understand, manage, and change the motives people have. 2logical offers over 30 different keynotes, workshops, and full training courses to small, medium, and large Fortune 500 companies in 53 countries, a lot of which you're probably familiar with: Pfizer, Bank of America, GE, Constellation Brands, P&G, and more. All solutions are completely customized, and the feedback from these sessions will blow your mind. If you have any training or speaking needs, or just want to say hey, head over to 2logical.com.